welcome to the GVA Legal Podcast. My name is Jean Kambuni and I'm your host. On today's episode, we'll be talking about the human rights movement in Kenya. And in studio with me is Mutami Kiama, a community organizer. Hello, Mutami. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Mutami Kiama. I'm a community organizer, social justice activist, and also a human rights defender. I work with communities around the issues that concern them, around when you talk about being a citizen in a country like Kenya. The Constitution talks about freedoms, rights, and responsibilities. A lot of people keep talking about rights and freedoms, but very few people talk about responsibilities. So I'm one of those people who is an active citizen. I take responsibility for ensuring that my society and fellow Kenyans are able to enjoy their rights as guaranteed by the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And I want to actually bring us into this human rights and human rights in Kenya. When did the human rights movement in Kenya specifically begin and why was it necessary?
So say, when you talk about maybe the formal formalization of the fight for human rights, then we would talk about early 90s. But human rights are inherent. So you can't really put a date on it. For example, when you talk about our freedom fighters, from way back after when colonialism came in, people organized themselves when they were the rest of their land as early as the 1920s. I mean, the organizations and associations that our various ancestors formed to ensure that they got their land back or they got their rights. When colonialism happened and people were put in, freedom of movement was curtailed, were forced to work in farms for cheap labor and that kind of thing. There's been agitation in this country to ensure that people are enjoying their rights for as long as we can remember. But the most recent iteration, which we'd call maybe the formalization or NGOization of human rights, is what happened from around 1990. I think the first formal organization, the Kenya Human Rights Commission, was registered in 1990, although not in Kenya, it was registered in New York. And then after that, the government established a competing organization, the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights, which was meant to kind of water down the effect of the Kenya Human Rights Commission. But I can say that the Kenya Human Rights Commission still exists today. It's the biggest human rights organization. They call themselves the premier human rights organization in the country, and has given birth to many, many other organizations that are now both nationally, but also CBOs within communities, some informal groupings around human rights. So, yeah. So let's say formally, early 90s during the struggle for second liberation, but human rights and Kenyans have been intertwined for as long as Kenya has existed.
I asked also about the why, and you've mentioned something in passing, the second liberation. What was the second liberation and why was the human rights, that iteration of the human rights, the Kenya Human Rights Commission and the government forming the competing Kenya National Human Rights Commission important? What was the struggle at that time that necessitated this agitation for human rights?
That's a good question. So what happened is that after independence in 1963, the government that came into power, and specifically Mzee Jomo Kenyatta's government, set out to consolidate power around the president, what we would call a dictatorship. And what that meant was that there was no room for questioning, no room for dissent. A lot of people who questioned, who raised issues, who were active citizens, were actually murdered. They died. We have many famous cases like J.M. Kariuki, Komwa Karumba, and others. There are many others who didn't even get the kind of exposure some of these guys got. And then we know that when he passed on in 1978, the next president was Moi, And he said he's going to Fuata Nyayo to follow the footsteps of Kenyatta. And basically what they did was to make sure that nobody could ask any questions, only what the president wanted happened. Kenyans felt stifled, felt that the government was not serving them. It was not there to serve them. It was there to serve the interests of a few. And so many Kenyans organized initially underground. You've heard about the Kenyans and other organizations that were, you know, were clamped down upon. And eventually the organizing became public. Especially after the debacle of elections around 87, 88, 89, whereby President Moi was trying to purge politicians who were vocal against him. And what happened at that time is that a lot of politicians now became openly, resistant and joined together with activists, organizing or laying the groundwork for the movement that began the human rights movement and the rights, the change movement in the constitution to allow multipartism and that kind of thing that began around 89, gained traction and came to head around 1992 when we had election and when Moi was forced to allow multi-party elections. So yeah, so that's Kenyans wanted freedom to organize, freedom of conscience, freedom to associate. And that kind of laid the basis for the movement, because then human rights are intertwined. When someone takes your rights away, that you can't meet like-minded people, that you can't think. Remember at that time they used to talk about you cannot even imagine. You know, it would be treasonous to imagine the president's death or things like that. The other president, yeah. So there was no freedom, really. I remember I was a teenager then, and people would not even mention the president's name because you're afraid, you know, someone would hear you and report you, and then you would disappear. So, yeah, so that then led to people organizing themselves to get the freedom that they needed.
You've talked about the economic and political situation that was that necessitated the agitation for the rights movement, at least in the 90s, up to the multi-party elections of 1992. Now, and that gives sort of a dichotomy between types of rights. So there are political rights, so the right to freedom of association, freedom of conscience, and then also there are the socioeconomic rights, the ECOSOC rights, if I could call them that. What types of rights are the most violated? What are the highest rights that are violated in Kenya, at least?
So what happens is that Kenya, if you know, like the genesis of the country called Kenya, it was created initially by a company called the Imperial British East African Company. And Kenya, I call it accidental. When I was an accidental colony, because the Kenya and East African Protectorate came about because some British explorers passed by here on their way to, they were searching for the source of the Nile. And essentially they were looking for a route to India, because the British Empire was collapsing around the world. They needed a route to be able to continue trading with India, because Indians were agitating for freedom that time. And they came and found, you know, us here just relaxing, enjoying our life, very, very resourceful country, you know, with a lot of very fertile land, natural resources all over. And they set up that company, the Imperial British East African Company, to now build the infrastructure to extract resources from this region. I don't want to use Kenya because it was both Uganda and Kenya, and take those resources to the UK or whatever the markets were. For example, if you think about the railway that was built, the railway was to get stuff from up country and to get to Mombasa, because the mode of transport then was on sea. So take it to Mombasa and put it in ships and take it up.
That's true. And then, that's true.
Yeah.
I think that's why they aptly named it the Lunatic Express. The Lunatic Express, that it was a railway to nowhere.
And again, contrary to popular belief that the Chinese are helping us develop, the railway, the SDR they built is not for Kenyans, it's for them to extract. It's the same thing, extract resources, minerals from now all the way from DRC, Goma, Uganda, Kenya, Sudan, South Sudan, and then take them to Mombasa and ship them to China. So it's the same model of extraction. Now, the economic system, then I'm talking about now economic rights, then that was developed then was to extract at the cheapest cost possible. So if you think about the resources then, it was the farming, you know, of the maize, farming of wheat, coffee, tea, and little mining here and there. And that at that time, you remember, it was just towards the tail end of slavery. And slavery was predicated about upon cheap labor, actually free labor, slave labor. And so because you could maximize profits by having free labor, Africans working in your farms for free, just a meal, maybe one meal a day. And that's basically what was replicated, what is called wage labor. I don't know whether you're familiar with how Africans, our forefathers in Kenya, were introduced into the economy. It was very brutal because they introduced taxes like hat tax. So if you're a man and you have a hat, then you're forced to pay tax for that. Mm-hmm. And then after the hat tax, they introduced the poll tax. So if your hat has a poll, that's for that. And then they introduced something called the breast tax. If you are a man, you have a heart as a pole, and you have breasts, women with breasts in your house, whether they are your wives, daughters, or whatever, then you have to pay tax for each of the breasts. And what this was meant to do was to force, because we weren't in a moneyed economy, we weren't using cash. It was to, and yes. We had no use for cash because our trade was different. Was to force men, African men, to now go and work so to be able get to cash pay tax, because you couldn't pay tax in kind. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we were uprooted from traditional ways of life, trade and all that, to go and work now in those Mzungu farms for peanuts, for very small coins, so that you could actually pay for tax. You know, we were, for example, prevented from using our traditional vegetables, which ironically we are getting back to because we're being told we are the healthiest. And introduced cabbages and sukuma wiki so that you could buy, and tomatoes so that you could buy, because the traditional vegetables were growing naturally bush. So we were brutally forced into the formal economy. And the reason why I'm giving that story is that for me, these rights are not separate, they're intertwined. So when you deny somebody the economic rights and you force them into another economy, then you're denying them the human rights, the rights to make a decision as to what they want to do with their lives. You're forcing them through strangling them economically to become slaves, wage slaves in your farms. And I think up to now, we've never recovered. You look at the industrial action that we are having, people working for peanuts in factories, you know, people earning salaries that you can't make ends meet, you can barely survive, you know, the kind of salaries that you have right now. I think the average salary of a university graduate is 30,000 to 40,000 shillings, which is basically just barely scraping. In fact, you have to live on loans from these banking apps. So when you deny people economic rights, then you're denying them all the other. So for me, the rights are not separate. They are intertwined.
So my understanding,
I hope I've responded to your question effectively.
Yeah, I think you have. And I think you've given me another way of looking at the common human rights violations in Kenya. You're trying to inform me that I cannot look at the current violations that we have right now in a vacuum. This current violations that we have, the current human rights, most common human rights violation, have their history in how we began our life as a country. We began as a business, an enterprise, and as any business is, they want to maximize profits, minimize losses, get the highest profit you can at the least cost that they can. So that began with getting forced labor, and the cheapest labor you could possibly find. And for you to get that kind of labor, it required for you to withdraw certain rights that those people inherently had. So the right to movement, there you couldn't go to any location. You needed a pass to be able to move from one location to another. It required a limitation of the amount of money that they could earn. It required a sort of elimination, if I can call it that, quote unquote, of any person who was against this system or who tried to agitate for more rights for the people working in this forced labor system. So that led to the beginning of what we now call extrajudicial killings. This required for us to realize that if I want to make it, once this state was handed back to ourselves, our Africans, who then did not change it, they just took it on. We are still a company and we're still looking for highest profit at minimal cost. Therefore, we now realize that for my community to make it, I have to be in control of the levers of power. I must be either the president or an MP. And that then made us have a very high stakes electoral system that then also led to ethnic violence around it, because we now have very invested in getting the levers of power and controlling them. This also led to the forced evictions that we still see, because the forced evictions began with the white man acquiring land to be able to grow large-scale farms of coffee, of tea, of the cash crops that not everyone could grow by law. So that what we see today as human rights violations are just the end result.
And just to add to that, when people talk about not yet Uhuru, it's just what you've articulated. That Kenya has never changed from the extractive colonial state. Still that company, the mentality, the leadership, the structure. Only that the white people withdrew from direct, being the ones, the face of it, and installed their royalists, who in Kikuyu, we call them the home guards. These are the people who were serving the colonial system then. And the thing is, the people who were serving the colonial system then are the ones who are able to take their kids to school. And so their kids are the ones who got the formal education to be able to serve the colonial state. And so, you know, they were taken to either to college or to university and all that. While the Burma went to the forests, others fight, so they're not able to educate their kids. So that has continued to date. And because that kind of people are very protective of their status, which they know is not the right status, the brutalization that continues with extrajudicial killings, forced evictions, the disdain for the ordinary person, ordinary Kenyan, by the state. As a lawyer, there's something called what is called the tribal police, which turned into the administration police, which was meant basically to help enforce this. There's an ordinance, I'm not sure whether it's 1935 or 36, of the tribal police. And specifically states that the tribal police was created to brutalize the population into submission. It was very clear, and that was the language. Because you're talking about a few white people who want to rule over millions of natives, and they needed a very brutal security service or force to do that. And that's the emergence of the so-called police force. Not service. You know, we've tried to change the name to service, but the force still remains because it was created to enforce, protect the elite from the natives. And that's if you look around, that's basically what's happening. That's when you talk about, that's one, when you talk about, you know, that dynamic has never changed. So even the police, because of the training that they undergo through the police standing orders, it's all about brutalizing the ordinary people. Second is the economy. If you look at the people who ended up, who became, you know, who are handed over to by the British to, you know, to take over the colonial system, for the British retreated. And by retreat, I mean they withdrew from the front. They didn't leave. They are still here. They still pull the strings from behind the scenes. The thing is that there's a character of these people. First of all, they are the people we say can sell anybody, including their own mothers. So they are greedy. They have no loyalties. You know, they have no sense of humanity. And that's why they're able to do what they're able to do. And if you look at Kenya today, if you look at who, say the president or governors or MPs, the character of these people, what Kenyans keep complaining about their leadership, it's because that's who the system rewards. The better a killer you are, the better, the more corrupt you are, the higher your rights. That's why in the, if you look at our governance in the last 10 years, since the new constitution was passed, people who are the best at corruption, murder, extrajudicial things, rise to become presidents, governors, etc., etc. You know, governor of Mombasa, governor of Nairobi, governor of Kimbu, president of Kenya. Now leave it there. That's the colonial extractive
state. Now I have a question that targets this colonial extractive state. In the language of human rights, talk about right holders, and that's us, the general population, and duty bearers, and essentially that's meant to be the state. The state is meant to carry that obligation of making sure that we are able to enjoy our human rights. What sorts of obligations arise out of these human rights, and can the state, can our state as Kenya meet these obligations?
So remember when we started, I talked about the responsibility of citizens. And that is, that has been the area where, for example, in the last two or three decades, billions have been spent, billions of dollars, not Kenyan shillings, have been spent on civic education to try and ensure that Kenyans understand their rights, you know, even the mobilization towards the new constitution, the education around it, so that right now, Kenyans actually know what the constitution says, they know what their rights. What has been lacking, what we don't have still is ownership. A lot of Kenyans think, okay, these are my rights, but it's the work of NGOs to fight for my rights, or the work of lawyers to fight for my rights. People still haven't taken responsibility or taken ownership of the country as citizens, as articulated in Chapter 1, in the preamble of the Constitution. You know, that we, the people, give ourselves this constitution, etc., and then delegated to the duty bearers, to the elected and appointed officials, and other people like us who've stood up for that gap. But the thing is, until that changes, until every Kenyan sees themselves as part of ensuring that their rights are respected and protected and ensured, which is where we. Part of what I do as a community organizer is we conduct what is called political education. This is beyond civic education. So civic education gives you the information in terms of these rights. Political education is a bit more delicate, because what it does is that it now connects the constitution, all these rights, to your life, why your life is the way it is. If you're sleeping hungry, why are you sleeping hungry when Article 43 says this? And what is the government supposed to be doing? If you're not able to pay school fees for your children, you're not able to get proper medical care, or if transport is expensive, its unga is 200, 300, what can you do? How do you, you're the same guy, maybe the same person who went to a rally for a politician and were given 200 bob. And then that 200 bob cannot even buy you unga, a packet of unga. So you still go home and sleep hungry. So, like, how are your actions or lack of actions then connecting to ensuring that you're electing leaders who can serve you well, who can actually be duty bearers, because they respect the jobs? You know, we have situations whereby you have an elected leader or an appointed leader giving Kenyans a lecture on TV or radio, like they are overlords instead of being servants. There were people saying they can't do their job, but they will not quit those jobs because what can you do about it? There's nothing you can do about it. There are people saying, nataka nifanya nini? Yet they are the ones who ask for the job. Remember our former president asking, nataka nifanya nini? You know, ideally, at that point, there should have been an uprising across the country. Fire him. When he says, then why is he in that job? He doesn't know what to do, then he should quit. Any other place where you work right now, that law firm that you're in, just wake up tomorrow morning and you say you don't know what. Tell me where you'll have a job. No, you don't have a job. Yeah. So why are we allowing people who don't even know what job they're supposed to do to occupy our offices and earn the best salaries? Because these guys are the best paid and then get the best allowances. best free things. We educate their kids, we take their kids to private international schools and that kind of thing. And yet it is us. So until we get to that point where we, the citizen, take that responsibility to ensure that duty bearers deliver, and if they don't, we fire them. That's the challenge I see. And that's what personally I'm very interested in, organizing our communities to be able to hold our leadership to account.
Yes, and I think that was the rationale behind giving the people the right of recall of your elected officials, to be able to hold them account to the things that and the activities.
Yes, which was made practically impossible, because when he says you can't recall somebody if they haven't served for 2.5 years, and then you cannot recall somebody a year to the next election, then the rigors of what I recall, you know, collecting, I don't know, a certain number of 30% of the registered voters within their constituency. There are some things that were put there. For example, and you're a lawyer, you know the tricks you guys use to serve your clients. If let's say I'm an MP and I'm recalled, you just go and put an injunction. Just to prosecute that injunction will take more than a year. Can take more than a year. Just use, you know, delaying tactics and all. So, which basically makes a recall impossible in this country.
Which is quite sad. But you did mention something else. You talked about a lot of the political education that you've been engaging in and educating the public on some of the rights that they have and some of the actions that they can use to hold their elected or appointed representatives to account on certain things, obligations that the state bears. And I want to now take us on a tangent about the interrelationship between resources and the realization of human rights. Can a lack of resources impede the realization of certain rights, or are certain rights require an immediate realization while others can be progressive? What relationship does resources play with the realization of human rights?
Actually, at a personal level, I have a huge issue with the idea of progressive human rights, because it's basically saying, okay, we agree, like as a government, you're meant to ensure that there's free or affordable education, quality education, free or affordable healthcare, affordable transports. You need a healthy population to be able to produce and pay tax, that kind of thing. But because we are doing X, Y, Z, we are not going to give you those rights now. So you wait until you get to a point where we can, I don't know, we feel like we can do that. I think that's problematic in itself. The fact that you're putting a caveat and you're buying time, instead of working from the word go to ensure that as a government, there's no other reason for you to be in existence as a government. Any government that cannot guarantee basic things, security of its people, healthcare, education, affordable transport, housing. What are you in power to do? And you know, we know about how neoliberal policies have impacted, capitalist neoliberal policies have impacted the world, whereby a lot of the services that are meant to, you know, we pay taxes for have been privatized, so that then you can take resources from, for example, garbage collection, so that you privatize that instead of Nairobi, let's say county, collecting garbage, they make it private. So then the taxes that are collected from Nairobians go to people's pockets, which is what neoliberalism is about. So progressive rights, for me, rights should be inherent. They should not be, I can have some rights now and the others I'll have when someone decides, okay, now it's time for you to enjoy these rights. First, so once you get, I think we get that, then it becomes like from the get-go, any government's mandate from the time it's sworn in is to ensure that those rights are enjoyed by all the citizens. And especially when you're considering that, you know, the constitution, the 2010 constitution was meant to write and change as transitioners finally from the colonial extractive state that uses its citizens. You know, look at the taxations that you're getting, you know, the way you're being taxed right now. You know, they're piling on more and more taxes. They're taking loans that don't help us. Right now, they put even more targets for, you know, bigger targets for tax correction. To do what? you know, to if they are not for ensuring that every Kenyan has a decent house, every child is going to school, every Kenyan can access healthcare, then what are those loans for? You know, and when are you going to have that conversation in terms of not progressive rights or whatever, but inherent rights? Like, why am I a Kenyan? What is the role of the state in my life if it's not providing those rights, if it's not assuring that I enjoy those rights? Not even providing the rights, that's the wrong language. It's assuring that I can enjoy those rights. You know, like, that language of progressive human rights actually was actually a negotiation for the government not to be held to be obligated to buy time, because as an extractive state, then the resources that would go to providing, to ensuring that Kenyans are enjoying those rights, they want to pocket them. They want to put them in their, you know, in their pockets. So that's for me, that's the only reason why they talk about progressive. And so for me, as a community organizer, is to ensure that Kenyans demand service now, not in 10 years' time, not in 20 years' time. Otherwise, if you can't guarantee those rights as a government, go home. Let those who can try and come and work towards.
So I'm going to bring us to our final question. And this question is on the human rights movement going forward. In the past, we had a very strong and a very visible civil society. I mean, in the 90s, in the 2000s, up until perhaps just after the passing of the 2010 constitution, the civil rights movement in Kenya was visible. It was big. It spoke for human rights, and it agitated for them, and they were in our faces. And I think that has helped to educate the Kenyan public and make us a more firm in our demand for human rights and for government to be able to meet its legal obligations with regard to human rights. What do you think is the future of the human rights movement in Kenya? Where are we headed?
Logically, just based on what you said, the human rights fraternity, the movement, then, you know, empowered Kenyans to understand their rights and demand those rights, then we should be, at this point, not having Kenyans expecting other people to fight for their rights. So I feel that that's something that we as human rights activists and the movement have not been able to achieve, is to get Kenyans whereby they make us relevant, that you don't need Mutemi Kiama to fight for your rights. You now know what your rights are, and you know how to fight for those rights. So for me, as a community organizer, actually, that's what I'm working towards. I'm working towards a point where we don't need Raila Odinga in the streets at the age of 79, no? Because the young people who are in their 18-year-olds and the 25-year-olds and the 30-year-olds know what they are entitled to and are able to work towards ensuring that they realize that. So I feel like there's a lot that has been achieved in terms of educating Kenyans, empowering Kenyans, and fighting for Kenyans' rights. But the gap that I feel is that Kenyan, the ordinary Kenyan person, and I don't like that word, but the ordinary, I mean, I don't believe they are ordinary and extraordinary Kenyans. All Kenyans are equal in my view. Mwananchi knows and goes, you know, fights for their rights. So for me, the future of the movement is when every Kenyan is part of assuring that the rights are observed, the rights are, and protecting each other's rights. So if I find you, someone is abusing your rights, then I'll take it up. I'll feel, you know, I'll feel the affront on me, even if it's not I who was being violated. I'll feel that affront and make sure that I do something to ensure that you're enjoying your rights. So that's what I and the people we are organizing with are working towards. Whereby, and I know a lot of my colleagues in the civil society are complaining that we do so much for Kenyans, and then during election they elect thieves. But I'm like, then there's something we haven't done right. Because if Kenyans understand their rights and then they still elect thieves, then there's a gap there. And I think for us, the future is to figure out what is that gap and how do we not become the people who fight for rights, but maybe become just facilitators so that Kenyans fight for their own rights.
So in short, you're saying that you want to eliminate the need for civil society occupying that space between the citizen and the state. You want the citizens to be able to come to government on their own and demand for their rights, demand that government meets its obligations. And also you'd like to get to a situation where Kenyans are educated enough and aware enough that they have a good criteria that they use to elect their public representatives. And these representatives should reflect their best values and not their worst, if I can call it that.
Yeah, that is very well articulated. And the thing is, the expanded definition of civil society is any space, any organized group that is not government and it's not business. So, you know, if you're part of a chama or any organization that is, what has happened is that most people conflate civil society with NGOs. Those are two separate things. Some NGOs are civil society, but that is not the definition of civil society. Anytime you organize yourself for your rights, if you're a member of, for example, you're LSK, you're a member of LSK, or any other association that you're a member of, that is a civil society organization. But I think people have conflated civil society with NGOs. So anytime Kenyans organize themselves for their welfare, that is civil society. And I think, so just to say yes to what you said, is just to put give it a bigger frame, is that Kenyans need to be able to organize themselves to attain whatever it is that they want to attain, knowing that what their rights are. And I think for me, that would be the success of the future, or rather the future of civil society.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank you, my guest, Mutebi Kiama. Thank you so much for joining us, for giving us these insights and for educating us on the history of civil society in Kenya.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity. I look forward to engaging maybe some other time in the future.
Thank you. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Tell us what you think about it. Our email address is info@gvalawfirm.com. You can also follow Gikera and Vadgama Advocates on social media. You can find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as GVA Law Firm. Thank you for joining us on the GVA Legal Podcast.